The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. The Bookkeepers by Niam O'Day. Lying down lazily on her green velvet sofa, Jane placed her tepid coffee on the enormous rug beside her and returned to her e-book. Wind chimes tickled in her blissfully overgrown garden outside. The lightest misting of rain tickled the windows. For the last 20 years, Jane had planned her retirement to a T. Some of her friends had planned round-the-world e-tours. Others were e-touring planets Jane had never even heard of. Her plans were simpler. Late nights, late mornings, and books. The rest of her days would be the same, save some obligatory human interactions. Sleep, read, sleep, read. Heaven. She hadn't read of mice and men since she was a young teenager, and had amazed herself that she remembered so many of the passages, the words and the feelings, not just of the book, but of the person she was back when she had first read it. Like music, books could make her a time traveler, returning her for a split second to the feeling of being that young lady. The smell of overly sweet body spray, the scratchiness of school tights, the inner tumult of hormonal upheaval, the bone-deep serenity of still having parents. As she remembered the words she read, she spent a millisecond back in her family home. When she tried to capture the moment, elongate it, prolong the beautiful, painful nostalgia of being who she was then, it would simply evaporate. But when she allowed herself to just read, just keep going, the flightiest of memories would embrace her entire body and ooze through her soul. However, towards the end of the book, the time traveling stopped. The passages became not quite unfamiliar, but more distant. As she rounded the ending, when George and Lenny laid the first stone for their new home on the land they had bought together, she remembered something more recent. The week before, upon completing 1984, she couldn't figure out what was out of place about Winston and Julia escaping the Big Brother society together and ending up rearing sheep on an Irish island. The week before, Romeo and Juliet uniting their families with news of their new baby. And the week before that, when Daisy Buchanan falls deeply in love with Jay Gatsby. She had read all these stories in her youth, some more than once, but their endings somehow felt at odds with her memories of them. Their endings seemed to have been born anew. They were satisfying, for sure, and truly hopeful, but they were somehow empty, not just of her recollections, but of depth, of feeling. She knew why, of course. The Bookkeepers, decades ago, there was a threat of war, or at least very real terrorism, when the book burnings began. The emotion that was incited on both sides was incendiary, and people got caught up in a moral and philosophical warfare. For some, literature was what it was, and there was undeniable value in its unedited storytelling, a time capsule of sorts, capturing not just the events of the day they explored, but the attitudes of society, and indeed the writers. For others, the content and views were deeply troubling, offensive, and unsettling. There was no place in our society for saddening and unenlightened opinions that could cause upset. Jane had taken neither side all those decades ago, too busy with work to really engage, and quietly confident that the right decisions would be made on her behalf. The bookkeepers ultimately made the decisions. But should she have paid more notice? By allowing the books of her youth to be remastered, had she lost not just the books themselves, but the entryway to the person she was when she first read them? And more worryingly, was this whole retirement really just a plan to relive her life through the books she had once read? Because considering it had been years, decades even, since her life had allowed her to pick up a book, there possibly wasn't much to relive. Just as she started to piece these disconcerting thoughts together, her watch gently buzzed and spoke. "You seem to be suffering with a little emotional turbulence," the phantom therapist stated. "Would you like to talk about it?" "No, not right now." "Sure. I'm here if you need me. Perhaps we could take a walk?" "Actually, a walk would be good," Jane replied, with an idea fizzing in her brain. "Where's the nearest library?" "The nearest library is 3,757 miles away. The New York City Library," the voice droned. "Right, well, where's the nearest place to view real books?" "The Literature Museum of Irving has a number of interesting displays that allow visitors to learn more about printed books. It is 4.27 miles away." "Perfect. Set a course." It took Jane 3.5 hours to make the short journey. Her aging body had no speed left in it, though her stamina remained unfailing. When she got to the small museum, located in a building that seemed to have been squeezed between two gyms, she was met by two armed guards. "Just visiting," Jane said giddily, her fear of authority sneaking up on her like a child. They did not respond, noting her as unlikely to be a troublemaker. The interior of the building felt larger than it looked from the outside, and the vast majority of it was dedicated to various revolutionaries who had fought, sometimes even literally, to have the classics preserved. She strolled past the memorials of these forward-thinking people who had made it their life's work to ensure that politics didn't destroy great works of literature that, though often deeply problematic, were hugely influential on the books and, more importantly, games, movies, and e-experiences that people spent so much of their time enjoying these days. A stern man with an eye patch stood behind a counter towards the end of the cavernous room, swiping his e-book disdainfully. "Hi, Em. Do you have any printed books?" Jane asked nervously. "What are you looking for?" he grumbled, barely breaking his gaze from the screen. of mice and men. The man pointed his dagger eye at her and raised an eyebrow. We have the e-book. Scan here. You don't need to come in here for this, you know. No, the actual book. I want to hold it. No, there's none left. None? What do you mean? There's none left. A few in New York, maybe, or some collectors might have managed to hang on to them, but we don't have any. Why do you want it anyway? There was not an ounce of kindness at the beginning of his speech, and by the end he seemed to be seething for Jane's very existence. Do you have a version of the original? No. The man started to peer nervously at the doorway. Where can I get a copy? Jane asked, completely unaware of the inappropriateness of such a question. Are you here to cause trouble? Is that it? The man said, his voice lowered to a growl. Are you one of those protesters, huh? Well, even if we did have a file of the original, you can't burn files, can you? And anyway, we don't. Protester? Burn? Oh, God, no, not at all. I didn't get involved in any of that stuff. I didn't even take sides. I thought each side had a reasonable enough point, to be honest, Jane blustered, her face flushing with shame. Her watch started to vibrate, but she discreetly pushed it to shush. This is just a museum, okay? Whether you like it or not, those books existed, and they don't anymore. They were part of the world, an important part once, and you people got your way anyway, didn't you? You've got your sanitized versions with no violence and la-di-da happy endings all round. You got your bloody AI-generated revisions and ruined it for the rest of us, he stammered, tears beading in his eye. Jane wondered if his watch was buzzing, too. I'm so sorry. I think you misunderstood me. I'm sorry. I'll go. And she left, fled, even if her sluggish pace could be described as a flea. She hailed a carriage and was home in minutes, sweating and mortified. She held her hands to her mouth. Her watch was quaking on her behalf, and she unmuted it to allow it to spill out its concern. Jane, you seem to be expecting intense emotional disturbance. Perhaps a nap could help things, it pleaded gently. No, I want another book. Wuthering Heights. I want to read Wuthering Heights. Wonderful choice. Wuthering Heights is awaiting you on your e-book. Tell me the plot. Wuthering Heights is an evocative love story set on the Yorkshire moors. It tells the story of Heathcliff and Catherine, who fall in love despite their social divides. What happens in the end? Heathcliff and Catherine shun societal norms and marry. Heathcliff earns his fortune through clever investments, and they grow old together in Wuthering Heights. What's the ending of the original? I don't understand the question. The original book. They don't end up together in the original, do they? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Jane couldn't understand why her heart was racing, her palms clenched, a sort of sorrowful rage was overtaking her. Was Wuthering Heights edited? In 2078, a number of revolutionaries fought to end the widespread book burnings and hackings that had persisted for some years. These revolutionaries, known as the bookkeepers, worked tirelessly to find a solution to the problems these books in their original forms created. The solution, an artful remastering of many of the classics, allowed these books to be preserved for generations to come. What were the problems they caused? Many of these books caused emotional turbulence that can be detrimental to the human mind. Jane knew all this. She was a teenager in 2078, more than 60 years ago now, and remembered the celebrations. At first, there were celebrations anyway. A compromise had been reached. Literature had been saved. But as time went on, the books weren't just edited to remove offensive passages. They became edited to include happier endings, to improve the messages, to soften the emotional turmoil they could inflict. These days, most of the classics were totally remastered by AI. The promise was that with new technology, old writing could be improved. What happened was they were edited into bland, heartless mush. The masters were remastered. Programs had mined the original author's works and completely rewritten the books. The same voice, it was claimed. The same writing style, prose, rhetoric, but improved. And there was another memory she was unlocking, a somewhat shameful one. Her mother belittling the bookkeepers over the kitchen table. Her mother and father bickering with each other. Words her father had said, something like, "Leave the girl out of it, for God's sake. She's a child. It's her future, whether you like it or not, and you can't change it." And then something else. Something gentle and tender, lying under a fort made from a sheet between her and her older sister's bed, holding books, real books, reading them furtively, reading them in her hands, the pages soft and padded. Her mother smiling, shushing, their little secret, reading the book, printed books, reading the temporary words printed in ink that would someday fade or burn. Tears ran down Jane's face. Not shameful, rageful tears. Big, fat, memory tears. The ones that cleanse, the ones that dislodge feelings and allow them to be held. She removed her watch and walked to a dresser in her kitchen and emptied it of its contents, then the chest of drawers in the living room. Under the stairs, she rifled through boxes and undershoes. Up the stairs, she searched her bedroom, her studio, even the bathroom. Finally, standing on a suitcase for height, she reached up to the attic door and yanked down the opening. A tinny staircase unfurling as she did so. She scaled the stairs unsteadily and rummaged rampagingly through the boxes of memories put on hold. Finally, she found one. A book. A real book. She sniffed the cover, the pages that had been pawed by so many people, and fanned them through her fingers. She didn't know how much she missed holding a real book until she no longer could. Black Beauty, her childhood favorite, the one her mother allowed her to keep like a secret. Buried in clothes she'd never fit into again and dolls she'd never play with. Black Beauty, the heartbreaking story of a horse, the book that, although she may not know it fully, taught a young Jane empathy, compassion, and hope. She returned to her green sofa with some effort and lay back, and she read. And as she did so, memories were dislodged. Memories like butterflies, there but gone, real but intangible. Feelings, memories of feelings. Her mother's stoic tenderness and ridged fingernails. her sister's contemptuous companionship and the smell of her morning breath, her best friend's loyalty and hair bows, the dreadful feeling of Monday mornings and the smell of her pencil case. She was transported, not just into Victorian England, but to her own childhood. Her own mind as a child galloped through her aged brain. She finished the book at 4 a.m. and slept through the following day. When she rebuckled her watch on Friday morning, it buzzed with algorithmic worries for her well-being. She ignored them, had a coffee, put on her comfy shoes, and walked the 4.37 miles. Upon entering the museum, she was satisfied to see the one-eyed man behind his desk. Not glancing up, he asked her what she needed without recognizing this was the troublemaker from a few days before. "I have something you might like to see," Jane muttered, opening her satchel to reveal the spine of the book. The man brought his pale hand to his mouth and then attempted to undo this betraying move. "Is that real?" he said firmly, yet quietly. "Yes," Jane said stoically. "It's real." "Don't take it out. Not here. Leave it in the bathroom. Collect it next week," he said under his voice, returning his gaze to his screen after a quick glance at the doorway. Jane did as she was told, thrilled by the secretiveness. She walked home the long way, unsure of what was to become of the book, of its recipient, or of her. When she arrived home, she returned to the attic and searched for more, but there were none. She lay on the sofa and wondered what she was so busy doing in her working life to have barely noticed the end of literature. Never mind to have borne witness to its demise. So busy. She was always so busy. Finally, at the age of 85, she was of retirement age and had little left for her to enjoy. She had missed an entire revolution with her eyes wide shut, yet had banked her entire life on enjoying what that revolution had been destroying. She had assured that what was decided for the best, yet allowed her existence to be rinsed of emotion, of depth. She had offered an outstretched wrist when the watches were updated to monitor emotions and thoughts. Yet, now that she had time for emotions and thoughts, there was nothing left to inspire them. She cried for 6 days. On the seventh, she returned to the museum, hoping against hope that her book would be waiting for her. It was not. Instead, there was a different book, on top of which lay a note. "I can give you black, Black Beauty, whenever you want it, but for now, borrow this and return it for a new one when you're done. We don't have many, but we have some, and that's a lot." Under the note was a copy of Mice and Men, stained, dog-eared, cello-taped, and with an ending that reminded her of her mother's perfume and made her weep. Paradise Lost, Honey Holmcroft. Calls for help came every day, in every language spoken, from Alpha Centauri to Xenoid 10. "Meteor, famine, war, help us," they pleaded. Whoever they was in that particular society that had figured out how to contact us. "Please remain calm," I used to say. "A unit will be dispatched to your location." But after our people went silent, the calls went more like this. Hello, we need help. We're sorry, but planetary assistance is no longer available. Our thoughts are with you during your pending apocalypse. Goodbye. Wait. And I would hang up and log the call for our directors, who would mark the planet for further study before its demise. No tears, just another experiment ending. Of course, Earth was different. It had been a special project for our people, a hunk of spasmodic rock that we imbued with the best of all things green and growing. Soft breezes, clear cold sea, and people. People who looked perhaps too much like us, in hindsight. Of course, we were sensitive when they called. Help, they called when they were cold and we brought them fire. Help, they called when they were hungry and we taught them our very own methods of tilling the soil. When they ventured out of their cradle to the hostile parts of the earth, we ushered in ages of warmth and good fortune that propelled them to prosperity. But help, they called, because they wanted more. And like permissive, enamored parents, we continued to give it to them until they wielded the means of their own destruction. The phone rang one night on my watch long after the silencing. I checked the caller ID twice. Earth. A little tingle of electricity ran up my spine. You've reached Thalia 9. How may I direct you? Hello, hello? Is anyone out there listening? Please. I need your help. Things are really getting out of hand here. An understatement if ever I'd heard. One given the mass extinction underway on Earth, amid the colossal storms and nuclear annihilation on a hair trigger. I'm sorry, I said, clearing my throat to prepare for the sentence that usually got stuck like dry wafer crumbs. But the Planetary Assistance Corps of Thalia 9 is no longer available for rescue requests. Our thoughts are with you during your apocalypse. Goodbye. The girl made an indignant sound of surprise as I hung up. It was the 9th call from Earth this week. I found in the log as I began to add my notes. All previous agents had deftly dispatched the callers, begging us to intervene to send another ship to save them. Caller reports escalation on Earth, I began to type. It would be of interest to the directors. Shrill bells jangled again. Earth again. I frowned as I picked up the line. You've reached Thalia. You can't hang up on me, the girl's voice said. The script prepared us for this scenario, though it was rare. Usually our callers were in such a state of shock to reach us that they didn't try again. Thank you for your call. While we understand you might be experiencing feelings of worry, anxiety, or dismay, the girl groaned in aggravation. Would you can it? My girlfriend is missing. We were supposed to shelter together this week, she said. Please, can you help me find her? I'm worried that she's lost or hurt. Shelter where? I wondered. And would have asked if the girl hadn't kept talking at a rapid clip. This girlfriend had fled their home after an argument about letting others into their shelter. Days on, she hadn't returned. How human to want to face obliteration together and to do it alone out of spite, I thought as she spoke. Finally, the girl paused her monologue. Look, I know who you are, she said in a low voice. I know you're not from here. This planet, I mean. But I know you're watching. This was highly unusual and would require immediate escalation to a senior agent. I thought I should keep her talking while I send a request. How did you find this line? It was on my grandfather's old MacBook. I live in his house now. He used to work for NASA. Had all kinds of notes with it. NASA was an ancient terrestrial space agency with whom we had coordinated many of our attempts at aid. What's your location? Reno. Well, Northern America, on the West Coast, if that's what you're asking. And your girlfriend's name? She paused and her breath hitched, as if the answer would break a dam she'd built across her emotions. Angel. And then the nervous feeling I'd been fighting back twisted through my arms and into my fingertips that hovered over the keys. I tapped A-N-G-E-L, one letter at a time. That was the name the humans gave to us long ago, before we abandoned them. No, not abandoned. Even silent, we had sent our best ship to evacuate a few hundred of them. It had nearly torn us apart. Oh, hang on, the girl said suddenly. A door burst open behind her. She set her phone down so the sounds were muffled, but I could just make out voices calling out in panic. A sound like static overwhelmed the line, and just as I looked down at the phone to check if we had disconnected, the door slammed, and the noise stopped. Frightened voices died down into a murmur. "Sorry, newcomers," she said as she picked up the phone again. I noticed that my heart had started to race. The protocol called this a sign of emotional investment. Understandable, but a sign to cut contact immediately. Only I had a message from the directors to stay on the line. We're unable to offer any additional assistance in departing the planet or averting disaster, I said with genuine regret. But the girl just snorted. I figured it was a limited time offer, she said. But please, could you find Angel? Could you help me bring her home? She has red hair, and she's very tall. Her cheeks are always red like she's been slapped across the face, even though she's way more likely to have slapped someone else. She has those lovely big round brown eyes, and she was wearing fatigues when she left. She was so angry. I should have stopped her. She keeps talking. Tell me about how they met as children, fleeing great ravages of dust with their families, and how they found each other again as revolutionaries. I thought I could perhaps grant this one selfless wish. It wouldn't be intervening, not really, to find her partner's location. It wouldn't have changed anything about their fate. And I had a few moments before the directors would appear at my shoulder. Stand by, I said in a voice barely above a whisper. And for the first time, but not the last, I defied Thalian protocol. I accessed our cameras and saw for myself how our great experiment on Earth was ending. A few clicks, and the distinct figure of a tall, red-headed woman in military garb appeared on screen. She was standing at attention before a gate, eyes locked ahead in terror as others streamed past her. On our satellites, I saw the storm heading for the geographic coordinates of the caller. The muffled static on the line grew louder. I can report that Angel is safe in a shelter in the next town over, I said. And I covered the mouthpiece before I spoke again, so she would not hear the waver in my voice. Tears I couldn't control dripped down my arm. Unfortunately, it may not be possible for you to reach her. One last moment of silence from this loquacious caller. She must have been able to hear the howl of the wind, the creaking of the timber board. She must have known before she called. I understand, she said. The sharp steps of the directors began to rap through the hallway behind me. I had a vision of myself seizing control and forcing them to help. We could still help. Thank you, the caller said. Thank you for finding her. Our thoughts are with you. The shallow words splashed through my head one last time instead. All I said, after the line was already dead, was, goodbye. Danny's Girl, revisited by Christine Richardson. Honey, I'm home. Danny warbled the words cheerfully, savoring them, willing himself to forget that he lived alone now and no one would answer. He closed the door gently, hung up his suit jacket, and loosened his tie. He imagined Carlotta emerging from the kitchen, swathed in her homespun apron, a dusting of flour on her nose and cheek, like a visitation of early winter snowflakes. There would be greetings and hugs and kisses and maybe a little hanky-panky on the couch before she confessed that her culinary efforts had led to disaster and they would have to order out. She had a dozen restaurants on speed dial, none of them cheap. He would smile and hand over his credit card, trying not to worry too much. But those days were over now. Tonight, he would microwave a frozen dinner and eat it alone, watching the news and reflecting that many other people had it worse than he did. He, at least, had his own one-bedroom condo with a flexible mortgage, a dry place to sleep, and a stack of marked-down dining options from the warehouse depot. It was past 6 o'clock. The traffic had been terrible, with construction delays, so it was time to shove one of those dinners into the microwave. But he was rarely hungry these days, and nothing tasted right without Carlotta's smile. He checked his phone one more time, hoping for a text message, an email, a death notice, anything. He had no idea where Carlotta was or what she was doing, and he needed desperately to know why she had disappeared on a Thursday afternoon in June, leaving no clues other than her abandoned possessions scattered around his condo. She had taken nothing with her except her purse. He had not dared to move anything for over a month, because she always took offense if he touched her things. Everything was now neatly repacked in her suitcase and stowed in the back of the closet, waiting. Waiting patiently day after day, hoping against hope, waiting as the seconds ticked by in a mournful parade with no end in sight. Danny parked himself on the couch and started going through his mail. Maybe he had missed something personal hidden between advertisements, charitable appeals, and self-aggrandizing leaflets from political candidates. Maybe, always maybe. Hello, Danny boy, how was your day? Carlotta's voice, rich and sultry, inviting him to paradise. Danny's head jerked up. Carlotta was standing in the entryway to the kitchen, leaning against the wall, swathed in the apron he had folded like a holy relic before depositing it in her suitcase. There was a spot of flour on her nose and on her left cheek, just as he remembered. He opened his mouth, closed it again, and then blurted out the first thing that came to mind. "Lose the apron, Carly. We both know you can't cook." He was horrified by his harshness. She hated to be called Carly, and pouted every time he suggested that she should upgrade her culinary skill. But what right did she have to expect anything else? She had been missing for almost 3 months. The apron vanished, along with the gobs of flour. Carlotta sashayed towards him and plunked herself on the couch. She was wearing her turquoise T-shirt split almost to her navel. He longed to bury his face in her cleavage and inhale the vertiginous fusion of rose and frankincense that erased all logic. But something was terribly wrong and he had to investigate. "What are you?" he asked. She smiled. "Don't worry, I ordered a pizza." Just like Carlotta, to completely ignore his pointedly relevant question. If this was some sort of entity, it knew her well. "Kale and anchovies," he said automatically. She responded with a sardonic laugh. "No, silly. Canadian with extra bacon and black olives, your favorites." "But you won't touch that. You believe that pigs are sentient and more intelligent than the average human." "I'm not Carlotta. I'm a memory engram. Part of you. Whatever you like, I like." It had to be a dream, a really crazy dream, but the doorbell was ringing. It was the pizza delivery guy. The box he handed Danny wafted a tantalizing aroma that made his taste buds dance. He decided to enjoy the moment. There had to be a logical explanation, and he might as well relax while he was figuring it out. He carried the box back to the living room, deposited it on the coffee table, and opened it. The first bite was heaven. "You want some?" he asked between bites. "Help yourself." "I'm not able to eat, but I am sharing in your enjoyment." "There are some cans of Diet Coke in the fridge. Could you fetch me a couple?" "I wish I could, but I'm an engram. A neurocerebral construct. I don't have a body." Danny considered that information while he walked to the fridge and back. "What are you?" he asked again. "If you're an engram, what are you doing on my couch? You should be safely stored in my hippocampus." "I don't fully understand what happened. Your obsession with Carlotta was eating up more and more storage space, creating a neurocrisis. It needed to discharge somehow, so here I am. Now we can talk face to face. How did you order that pizza?" "I am part of you. I know your credit card number and anything else you have memorized." "I hope you added a tip. I don't have any cash in the house." "Right. Just 3/4 in the drawer of your computer desk. Cash makes you nervous, because you can't track it online." Danny was impressed. This version of Carlotta really did know everything about him. That was threatening, but also strangely comforting. If anyone could understand him, it would be her. "How could you order a pizza without my knowledge or consent?" he demanded. "You had a strong, repressed craving. You would have ordered it yourself eventually." Danny took another bite, grunting with satisfaction. How could he have deprived himself for so long? There had been no Canadian pizzas with extra bacon and black olives during Carlotta's reign. Everything had been about her. Everything had been about her. But it had been so worth it. Coming home to warmth and cleavage and perfume, even if Carlotta was the queen of messes and her preferred food was overpriced and unpleasant to eat. Danny finished a third piece of pizza and opened the second can of Coke. He sat back, more contented than he had since Carlotta's disappearance. Carlotta, or her reasonable facsimile, watched him with that familiar half-smile. "So, what happens now?" he asked. "I'm not sure. I think you need some reality therapy. Carlotta is not coming back, and that's a good thing. She's a con artist and was just using you until she found a new sugar daddy. You know all those times she told you she was going for job interviews? She was following up on dating site contacts." "What? That's crazy." Danny bounced to his feet, floundering in tidal waves of emotion. Engram Carlotta's claims were outrageous, like kicks to his gonads, but his gut was telling him that she was not lying. He towered over her, willing her to change her story. How could you possibly know what Carlotta was up to? I don't know. It just happened. Around the time that Elon Musk was launching Neuralink, my abilities began to expand. I could surf the internet everywhere, even places you didn't want to go. I started stalking Carlotta, reading her social media feeds and text messages. Danny vividly remembered the breaking news about Neuralink, how human brains were being melded with artificial intelligence to overcome disabilities. He had been disturbed by the thought, but at the same time, the idea was tantalizing. Had some of that AI energy leaked beyond its specifications, perhaps into the internet? "Have you become self-aware?" he asked Engram Carlotta. "I don't know exactly what that is supposed to mean. I am experiencing new urges. I shared your enjoyment of the pizza, but I would like to have a body of my own so I can have a first-hand taste experience. I want to explore everything beyond anything you have ever imagined." Her voice trailed off, and she stared into space as if she were looking back 50 light years through the Hubble. "There is so much to explore." Danny sat mesmerized. This version of Carlotta could not offer him sexual delights, but she could be the best friend he ever had. "We could learn a lot from each other," he said. "You can learn something from me right now. If you look at your text messages, you will see a photo of interest." He picked up his phone reluctantly, closing his eyes, hoping everything would magically return to 3 months ago. It had been far from ideal and prohibitively expensive, but it was the best sex he had ever had. "Cut it out!" Carlotta's voice jolted him back into the present. "Look at the photo." Danny looked. He gave a low whistle. "Where did you get this?" "While you were pining, I was investigating. With a little effort, you could have done it yourself." "You're sure it's not photoshopped or anything?" "It's the real thing. That's Armenio Arbacer, head of Argentina's most powerful drug enterprise." "And Carlotta married him? How did they even meet?" "Dating site. He bought her a plane ticket and off she flew. She will do well. He's noted for his generous divorce settlements and non-disclosure agreements." "So you found this out independently, even though I didn't want to know?" "You wanted to know. You were just afraid." Danny sighed. "I'm a good programmer, but hopelessly pathetic where emotions are concerned." "You can change. Then we'll both be happier." "Where do we start?" "Throw Carlotta's suitcase in the dumpster." "There's good stuff in there. I'll take it to Goodwill tomorrow." "Some things just need to be dumped. Do yourself a favor." Danny chugged the last of his Coke and marched to the bedroom. He dragged the suitcase from the closet and headed out the door. When he returned, he was smiling. "That felt good. What's next?" "You start living your life. You're imagining some sort of comfy relationship with me, but you deserve something better than talking to a projection of yourself. You need the warmth of human companionship." "Ow," Danny said. "You know I'm clueless in that department." "Stephanie at work likes you. Talk to her." "Really? I had no idea. I really admire her creativity. She always manages to take a leap outside the box when you reach an impasse with a project." "She has a great personality in other ways. The Rose Cafe is her favorite coffee shop. Invite her for a pick-me-up after work. Get to know her. Ask her out. Will you coach me? Coach yourself. You know everything I know. Can't you and I just carry on together for a while? Sort of a practice run? Forget it, Engram Carlotta said, and disappeared. Danny was never sure afterwards whether the whole thing had been a dream or perhaps a fugue state that allowed him to order the pizza without being aware of what he was doing. Whatever happened, his life started to change for the better that day. He never saw either version of Carlotta again and didn't miss him a bit. He was far too busy getting to know Stephanie.